From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Paranoia, frustration, and patience. Not the kind of things you think of when you think about a war story, but the seven-hour miniseries Generation Kill on HBO deals with just that. The director of four of the episodes, the first three and the final, Susanna White, is here with us. Thanks, first of all, for doing the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on it.
It comes from the book, but tell the audience a little bit what's about it.
It's based on Evan Wright's book, Generation Kill. And Evan is a journalist who embedded with the 1st Reconnaissance Unit.
And did dispatches for Rolling Stone.
Right, exactly. And we follow his journey on the first 40 days of the war as 1st Reconnaissance Unit spearhead the invasion. And we tell the story of that group of guys.
And what you really get a sense of is the incredible frustration and the kind of tension that frustration creates in the fact that these guys are all built to go out and fight, and they're completely overprepared and underprepared.
That's what's great, I think. You know, in episode one, you see them all pumped up, ready to go. They're working out. There's a kind of physical honing of them as they, you know, they see themselves in a warrior tradition, getting right back to the ancient Greeks, that they're warriors ready as a machine to go out and fight. And then you see their frustration as it doesn't turn out in the way they were expecting. And one of the things I really love about the series is the boredom of war, the downtime.
And it's mostly the downtime.
Yeah. And that's when you really get to know the characters, that they talk about their backstories, stuff at home. You get to see the dynamic between them. And in a way, it's what drew me to the project, that as well as being a war film, it's a big extended road movie.
It really is that, and almost as much comedy as a Bob Hope Bing Crosby. I mean, there's so much dialogue in this, and the dialogue is so telling for each of the characters.
It's one of the great things about David as a writer.
You're talking about David Simon.
David Simon, who is best known for The Wire so far, that he makes no concessions to the viewer. I mean, I think people are dropped into episode one, into the world of you know, what he calls the vernacular of the Marines, the Argo is another word he uses to describe it. But basically, he just makes the Marines talk the way they talk for real. They don't explain stuff. So it's not a particularly easy watch, but it's an incredibly rewarding watch, I'd say.
If I had not read this beforehand, I would be completely lost. Were you worried about that a little bit?
I was worried about that. I mean, to be honest, when I was sent the script of episode one, I had to use Evan Wright's book as a kind of learning aid to take me through it. But I found when we had actors into audition that when we got the right person in, the meaning became very clear of what they were saying. And I think, by episode two, you really are understanding. And David Simon personalizes the dialogue very much. So everybody speaks, you know, they speak Marine language. But, you know, for example, Colbert has a very formal, kind of quite archaic way of speaking, loves rhetoric. Person, his driver is constantly wired, babbling away.
And it's almost like watching The Honeymooners between Cramden and Norton. He's always telling him to shut up, but it never stops him from talking.
I love it. I mean, Evan says in the book, he said the dynamic of that lead Humvee was like a family on a road trip, that Colbert's the dad, Person's the mum, and Trombley, this new recruit who's dying to kill someone. He wants to shoot. He's all pumped up, ready to shoot. It's like the kid in the back seat was asking, "We there yet?" Wanting to eat candy in the back seat. And then there's Scribe, the journalist, who's like the uncle who maybe outstays his welcome a little bit.
But it's great because, as you talked about that, and then what Wright said about it being like being in the family car. There's so much singing that's like taking a road trip, and songs that you can see they've. In effect, as he gets at this in the book, they kind of run out of songs by the time they're singing Tainted Love. You know, there's nothing left for them to sing.
Well, I love that. It's something I arrived at in rehearsal, that singing, because David was very clear. He wanted no score. And that left me very naked as a director. There's no place to hide. But I was talking to Evan in the rehearsal time out in Namibia, and I said, you know, what, was there no music? And he said, well, the music was stuff they sang themselves. So we went back to Evan's notebooks and found what the songs were that they sang. And then we improvised a whole lot of stuff around this singing, and it's ended up being a big feature of the show, I think, the singing in the Humvee.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Susanna White, who directed 4 of the 7 episodes of Generation Kill on HBO. Well, one of my favorite bits in it is in episode 7, where a big pop culture reference comes in. I'll just say it's to the in-laws, and I won't say anything else.
Right.
We get a chance to see him finally sort of involve himself, the writer, and it's really funny.
I mean, it's one of the reasons we picked Lee Tergesen to play the role. He is a wonderful comedic actor, as well as being a very good serious actor. And, you know, he's the eyes and the ears of the piece in a lot of ways. But at the same time, he's just very, very funny. And there are a lot of laugh-out-loud scenes, which, you know, I think people watching this early on didn't know whether that was quite comfortable to really laugh about the war.
Is that true?
Yeah, some people we showed it to. We showed it at Camp Pendleton to the Marines earlier this week, and they were howling because they recognized the truthfulness of it, that gallows humor is a way they survive combat. It's what soldiers have always done, I guess, that they laugh at their situation. It's like doctors, you know, laughing at serious medical things. It's a way of surviving just how dark the situation is.
I was actually reminded quite a bit of Robert Altman's MASH. And I wonder if that was kind of a touchstone for you in the way that you directed the scenes.
It was a touchstone for me, but equally, I just tried to come to the material fresh. I watched war films as references, but at the same
time... Which did you watch? Which films?
Oh, I watched Platoon, Thin Red Line, a French film, Beau Travail, about the Foreign Legion. I watched Three Kings, which I love. Apocalypse Now. I watched all the big references, and in the end, I thought, I've got to throw that away and just do my own stuff. My background's in documentaries before I went into drama, and I just wanted to make it feel real, that we were back with the world of those guys at the beginning of the war, not having the benefit of hindsight, all the stuff we know about where the war went afterwards. I wanted to see it from inside the world of the Humvee. And we had an early reference photo from the New York Times, which the photojournalist had just taken a shot looking down at the boots of a Marine, he didn't know who he was, with all the clutter inside the Humvee. And I love that photo because it's a very small perspective of the war. They didn't know the big decisions that were going on beyond them. You know, it's very specific what we were doing. We were saying, this is their world inside the Humvee, and that's the story we're going to tell.
I wonder if it scared you that there were so many speaking parts and so much dialogue. And really, it's about the middle of episode 3, we finally get a sense of who everybody is.
It was huge. And one of the things I set out to do, watching these war films as references, I was aware how easily you could get lost and not be able to tell one person from another.
Oh.
That, you know, they all have the same haircut, they all have
camo gear. Because they're wearing helmets most of the time.
They wear helmets. So one of the things we set out to do in casting was to make people look as different as we could from one another. We had a voice coach working on their very specific accents to make people sound different from each other. I customized the costumes where I could. So Doc Brian, the medic, has a bandana he wears. Patterson, one of the officers, has a black and white scarf he drapes around him. Rudy, Marine who's always working out and conscious of his appearance, has got a customized chicken suit, he calls it, a camo jacket that he wears. And I tried to personalize the Humvees as well. So Rudy's Humvee has a hula girl on the dashboard. Another Humvee, they collect Tabasco bottles as they go through the campaign and fill them with sand from each place there's been a gunfight. So there's small details, but where we could, I really tried to personalize it. I think it's very tough. It's a huge cast. As it unfolds, you do get to know exactly who everybody is. But episode 1, intentionally, you're thrown into the chaos of it.
It's The Treatment. We're talking about the 7-hour HBO miniseries Generation Kill with the director of 4 of the episodes, Susanna White. It's also a war film about claustrophobia.
Right. They're cooped up with each other for a long time and, you know, plenty of time to get on each other's nerves. But they're very close to each other in a way that surprised me a lot, I think. You know, I spent time with real Marines before I started shooting. And also I spent a lot, we had three military advisors on the show, and I just spent a lot of time hanging out with them. I think one of the great things about Evan Wright's book is he gives you so much backstory on each of these characters. So, for example, Rudy Reyes, who's in the show, he plays his own character in
the
show.
That was pretty incredible.
We brought people in. We tried to cast his character with actors. We saw an awful lot of actors in New York and L.A. to play the part of Rudy Reyes. In the end, David Simon and I looked at each other and we said, can we have Rudy play Rudy? Because there's no one out there who's like Rudy. You know, Rudy was very surprising to me. He'd grown up in boys' homes in Omaha, Nebraska. He'd had a very tough life growing up. He learned fighting as a way of survival in the boys' homes. He did martial arts. And then he became a Buddhist before he went into the Marines. His favorite food is sushi. He overturns all the cliches you'd expect of what a Marine is. And what he said to me early on was that the Marines gave him a family. He hadn't had a family there for him when he was growing up. And his brothers he went to war with really were family for him. He said, I felt as if I was being hugged and stroked by these guys for the first time in my life. And I knew they were there for me in a way nobody ever had been. That's what I gained by talking to those guys, just how close these relationships are. And you know, it's hard for anything ever to come near to it for them. I think when they come home, it's tough.
You know what it's really like, and I really found this, again, it hit me in episode 3, it's like watching a drawing room play. You know, I mean, just because it's, for the most part, it's in such close quarters that it's really, and I asked you this when we got started, how many of the actors were stage actors, because it feels like theater to me in that way, that it's about the chemistry of these people in confined spaces.
Well, that's the biggest compliment you could pay me, because that's what I hoped it would be. You know, a lot of them are stage actors. They're fantastic actors. They're not big names. It was a big freedom HBO gave us. There was no pressure on us to cast famous actors. We were encouraged not to. They're fantastic actors, and they might not be well known now, but I hope by the end of this there are going to be some big names emerging from it, because I think we were very lucky to have the freedom to choose absolutely the most talented guys for the role.
But you had to ask a lot of them, again, because it's about being able to manufacture that kind of chemistry that those guys got in a very different kind of context.
Yeah, but you know what? We were out in the middle of Africa. Okay, I mean, we're not in the real danger situation those guys were, but we're out in the desert together, and we became like a family. We became very, very close. One of our policies in trying to make it feel authentic was we called almost all the actors to the set every single day. People didn't have days off because we wanted the background action to be truthful. So if one set of guys were talking, in the background you'd see other characters carrying water cans, taking a leak, eating MREs. What that meant was there was a lot of hanging around for real for these guys on the set. And while they were waiting, they completely bonded with each other. So there was a different group dynamic in each Humvee. And that developed, you know, it was wonderful to watch as a director to see this big and diverse cast grow into the skin of their characters as we went on. So, you know, by episode 7, when James Ransone, playing Person, meets an Iraqi guy who comes up asking for Valium in episode 7, he went into a big improvised riff that was completely truthful to the character. And that's just because after 7 months in Africa, he had become his character, Person.
We'll take a break. My guest is director Susanna White. She directed 4 of the 7 episodes of HBO's miniseries Generation Kill. I'm Elvis Mitchell. That's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is director Susanna White. She directed 4 of the 7 episodes of HBO's miniseries Generation Kill. I wonder if it helped having a cinematographer who had also shot Live from Baghdad, who had some sort of sense of, or could bring some of that kind of feeling of shooting a real life occurrence that took place in that part of the world in documentary terms?
I think so. You know, Ivan Strasberg, who is a cinematographer, comes out of documentaries. He's a remarkable guy. And together we came up with this idea of the handheld camera, a very reactive camera, so that the camera has no more information than any of the Marines did. So if there's a sound off to the right, there's a beat, and then the camera swings to find it. Also, Ivan was just very, very practical. There'd be things like, I'd like a shot because it had a tree in it, and Ivan would say, yeah, but you know, there's mangoes on the tree, we can't have mangoes, we're in Africa, we're meant to be in Iraq. And he had very specific understanding of what the terrain was like.
I guess what there really is, which adds to that frustration, is that kind of tunnel vision where you can only see so much. I mean, even because you have a lot of, and you started off in ways that sort of make us think we're seeing something conventional. There are lots of big expanses and lots of scenes of the men milling about, and we get to see the skies and so the caravan moving almost as if it really is a caravan. And then you go away from that very quickly into these very tight quarters, which sort of signals that these guys go from having all this visual information around them to not knowing anything.
I mean, they're out on their own, and it's tunnel vision. And we tried to mirror that visually, that we had shots which were packed with stuff around the edge of the frame, that inside those Humvees, it's really cramped. There's no big support column behind them.
And the windows are really dirty.
The windows are really dirty for real, which wasn't hard to achieve in Africa, I can tell you, when we had such inhospitable conditions that our catering tent blew away three times in dust storms in the desert. It was physically quite tough. I mean, obviously not as tough as it is for the real guys out there in Iraq, but for a film crew, it was quite tough conditions we were shooting in. You know, sometimes it was 100-degree heat with high humidity in Mozambique, dust storms in the desert, very, very hot in the daytime in Upington in South Africa, very cold at night. In some very small way, it mirrored the experience of what it was like for real.
I have to ask you, if you wonder that as a culture, if we have enough distance, because it still feels so close to us now. And there's still a lot of information that people don't have about what happened in those 40 days and how people will react to the series because of that.
Because people aren't distanced enough yet.
Yeah.
Only time will tell, really. What I'm hoping is that because it's telling such individual stories, that really it's about the flesh and blood of these guys who went out there and what they're like on the inside. And that's really the story we're telling, what it was like for them in the very beginning. In a sense, to me, it doesn't matter that there isn't the big perspective on it yet, because it's telling a very specific and individual story. And I hope it'll stand the test of time, because it's such a basic human story we're telling.
What was your first conversation like with David about coming on to direct?
My first conversation was about how I wanted... What I admire so much about The Wire was David's use of non-actors as well as real actors and the veracity of what he does. And I said, that's what I wanted... What I loved about the writing was it was very character-driven, and what I wanted to do with it was put characters at the heart of the piece. So although I'd never done them before, I wanted to do big action sequences and do the explosions and the firefights. What really drew me to the piece was this very human story. And I think in some ways it helped me to be an outsider, to be British, to be a woman. I had no agenda coming to it other than drawing this group of guys and making them come alive. We wanted people in some ways to turn on and think, is this a documentary I'm watching? What is this show? Interestingly, a lot of people have asked me since, how come, you know, you're a woman, you directed Jane Eyre, you directed Bleak House, you're a very unlikely choice. Why on earth did you come to do this piece of work? But actually, none of that was ever an issue for David Simon, because he saw in a lot of ways they're very similar. They're character-driven stories where a big story unfolds over a long time, and they tell the story of a diverse group of individuals, and that's which is nuanced and layered in performance. And the performance, hopefully, is very truthful. And so you know, our goals were very similar. It might be contemporary, set in the war and with an all-male cast, which I must say is the first time I've ever done that. but it really wasn't a million miles from Bleak House in terms of ambition.
The woman who stepped up to this task is Susanna White. She directed four of the episodes of the 7-part HBO series Generation Kill. It's the treatment. But one of the things that Bleak House even has in common with David's work is kind of a failure of the system, how the system doesn't really protect people, and just the politics of that engenders, and people working towards a goal and the futility of all of that.
Yeah, absolutely, because in Bleak House, the system it's the legal system in Bleak House that fails people, that it's about a dispute over an inheritance, that ultimately the whole inheritance goes to the lawyers.
But Dickens was basically a journalist who used his own anger to deal with London's social failings, and in the way that David, as a journalist, sort of dealt with the failings of Baltimore and turned to Evan Wright for that here.
Absolutely, and writing in installments. And I think David sees himself very much in that tradition. You know, he says he sees himself in a tradition of Balzac and Dickens, and even going back to the ancient Greeks. That the, you know, in this, he said they welcomed the warriors, as they like to call themselves, these Marines. Welcomed scribe in, because all warriors know they need their storyteller. That goes right back to the Iliad, you know, that this is a story of a group of individuals under the pressure of war. And that's a very ancient story. It's also a very contemporary story.
And these guys, it's so amazing because this really does go back to Wright's original material. They really saw themselves as all of them as anachronisms, kind of.
Absolutely. And They're very aware of that. They're very self-aware, these people. I mean, when I went to Camp Pendleton early on, it overturned my expectations in many ways. But almost the biggest thing was I saw them go over an assault course. There were guys treading water in full combat gear for an hour, holding weapons over their heads. And I was expecting the sergeant major type you see in the movies to be shouting at them to get them to do it. And there was no shouting going on. And I said to one of the people there at Camp Pendleton, what motivates these people? And he said, it's all about achieving your personal best. It's all about driving yourself as far as you can go and doing the best for the guys you're with. And constantly, as I got to know this story, it surprised me. It's one of the things I love about the show is it subverts cliches and it overturns expectation.
Well, it's funny because there's a line that's repeated a couple of times over the course of the series, but really for me became kind of the theme, which is that the Marines are about making do.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's another bit that I love. It's like Gilligan's Island here, that these Humvees are held together virtually with rocks and string. And they hadn't had much training on the Humvees before they went out there. They were customizing them at their own expense.
And there are Marines who are still waiting for pieces of equipment that they've ordered.
Right,
because
mail order.
Yes, because they're completely underserved by what they're issued by the Marines.
Right, they're short of batteries. Colbert's paying for a shield for his gun turret with his own money, we see. And very, yeah, there's very, very
describe
basic.
Describe that as flag vest from eBay.
Right. I love that. Which he doesn't know how to put on. And they get the wrong camouflage. They're sent woodland camouflage rather than desert camouflage. But yes, you see the chaos and the randomness. And unfortunately, that's based on real stuff that happened.
But the thing that's kind of fascinating is that you build to moments that generally in war films are kind of relieved by violence, a certain outburst of violence. But what really happens is that the violence is happening all around these people until they get to Baghdad.
Right.
And then that's when they actually get to the war, because they get the chance to see what the results of that war have been.
And it's a real moment of disillusionment for them, I think, you know, when they finally...
But it's been building. I mean, these small moments of disillusionment that build to finally to this mountain of disillusionment, because they expect things to be different. And what they're finding is even as they go from neighborhood to neighborhood, they can't really police anything.
And, you know, in that final episode, although it's only the beginning of the war, I think we see the whole story of the war, that it shows the complexity of the situation there. They're torn apart by seeing there's no way. They can solve things. There are no easy answers here. And whenever they try to fix something, they're moved on. And I'm very proud of that final episode, because I think in a small way it tells the big story.
to The Treatment. I'm talking to Susanna White, who directed four of the episodes of HBO's miniseries Generation Kill. It's funny because that last episode is often where most war movies begin.
Right. And it's where we end.
Yeah.
Well, I think because we feel that the drama is in the moments between the drama. It's not in the big firefights. It's in the minutiae of the situation there that it unravels in that final episode just how complicated things are. And there are no easy answers.
And that self-awareness you're talking about really hits home then, because these guys see how completely ineffectual they've been.
Right. They've put themselves through enormous danger. And they get there and they think, has this all been for nothing? They're faced with that in a very real way. You see the inadequacy of their translator, who's unreliable. Another translator comes to help them. He's unreliable too. They don't know who they can trust. They want to help people, but the command structure won't let them help people in a practical way on the ground. And then you see them heading home thinking, what was all this for? We were sold something that wasn't as it is.
No, it's finally what you could say is that even happens to some extent in Jane Eyre, where the real casualty is innocence.
Absolutely. You see these guys grow up, a lot of them. They're very, very young and fresh-faced at the start of the show. And on that journey, on that road trip, you see them grow up in a huge way.
But one of the things that, to me, links this to The Wire is that how that sort of that infrastructure is really kind of damaging, because it's all about self-protection, you know, and characters we think of initially as having some kind of sense of things, like Godfather, turns out to be, again, just another self-motivated officer.
Ambitious, wanting to do well. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it's like any boss in any situation, you know, the bosses are flawed. We can all relate to that. We all know what that's like. I think what we saw in this was a lot of the senior officers hadn't been in combat before. The guys on the ground are often much more experienced than the guys above them. And putting them into situations of danger, that these guys know how terrible that's going to be. And it's so random. There's a wonderful scene in episode 3 where a person's incredibly frustrated. He's going, stop, you know. What the hell's going on here? You know, there is no plan. And, you know, you see the randomness of the whole experience.
And how the moments of competence really draw them together. I mean, that's when people learn who they can trust.
Right. And ultimately, it's each other they can trust. That their brothers in the Humvee are the guys they can really trust.
Well, Susanna, thanks so much for doing this.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
My guest is director Susanna White. She directed 4 of the 7 episodes of HBO's miniseries Generation Kill. Our recording engineer is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey, the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.